the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Low Bros History Podcast. If you've been with us before, you know what to expect. We're traveling back in time. We're going to hit it strong. We're doing Dwight Ike Eisenhower today. And I'm always here with my brother,
Jacob Lowe. And if you're new listening, basically what we do here on the podcast,
is we
discuss a historical figure, historical events surrounding that figure.
To the best of our ability.
To the best of our ability. And
It's usually someone we're very interested in, and we like to talk about the facts of who he is, but also at the same time, kind of put a little tweak on it. You know,
It's like giving the facts and having an open discussion.
I'm not opposed to free thinking.
So
we'll talk about Dwight Ike Eisenhower, a little bit of his background, some bio. And then we'll get into his, obviously, World War II career and also his presidency.
Yeah.
Pretty decent president.
Yes. Very, very...
He's a very good president, actually.
Very good president, yeah.
Jake's got some... Jake dug into the presidency. He's got he's got some good stuff on the presidency.
I wish we could have him back.
Desperately needed.
Yeah.
It was a great... But the key themes for this episode, leadership, decision-making... Just a stand-up guy.
Yeah.
You know, very encouraging, high, kept the morale high, was alive during four U.S. conflicts, if we include Vietnam and Korea.
Well, he was...
Or was Korea first?
Korea was first. Right. He left office before Vietnam.
He left office. Okay, okay.
But we'll get into, he did do a good job at preventing the U.S. from going... to war with Vietnam, you know, because we'll talk about it. That's confusing.
We'll talk about it.
But we'll talk about it.
Yeah, World War One, World War Two, after World War Two, the Korean War,
Cold War,
the Cold War. I mean, the man lived a life. I'll tell you, people.
Yes, he did.
The man lived a life, and he's a leader. And we study these guys because it applies right to today. It's stuff you can put in your back pocket and think.
Yeah, which we try to relate it to today.
Yeah, yeah.
Make some, you know, like I said, you know, it's part giving you the facts, part, you know, open discussion.
So, I didn't even think about this, but you would just want to jump into the bio, or
let's just jump into the bio.
Let's go jump into the bio. Give the people some background.
This is just kind of his early life, and you know, so he was born in Denison, Texas, on October 14th, 1860.
He's a Texas?
But
he's a Texan?
He's a Texan, native Texan, but he grew up in Abilene, Kansas.
Okay.
So, now, Ike's family was poor. He was the third child out of six brothers.
He has six brothers?
Yeah.
So, despite Patton, who grew up very wealthy,
Ike was
rather poor.
Yeah, Ike was really poor. His family was really poor.
Low on the totem pole.
Yeah, so, you know, like from an early age, you know, his parents had him and all of his siblings working at a young age, you know, instilled that work ethic.
Yeah.
You know, very early on to support the family and
make
sure that there was food on the table.
Yeah.
You know, roof over their heads and, you know, clothes on their backs, that sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah, and they were, his family is all devout Mennonites.
Are they really?
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Just attended a Mennonite wedding over the summer.
You did?
Yeah, yeah. The bride and groom weren't Mennonite, but it was at a Mennonite church.
Ah.
Somewhat similar to, they like the cool
Amish.
They like the cool Amish. Yeah. Like they're like Amish, but they're like
they still drive cars.
They still drive cars.
They have cell phone. Yeah.
So shout out to all the Mennonites out there.
Whoop whoop
whoop whoop.
So, but then in 1911, Eisenhower won an appointment to attend West Point.
Oh right, he did.
But his mother protested against it because she was a pacifist.
Oh, yeah, Mennonite. Back to that Mennonite background.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was a pacifist and didn't, you know, I want to say didn't believe in war is kind of really weird to say, but just didn't believe in going to war.
Right, is a better way
to put that.
In West Point would really shape Ike.
Oh yes,
right. I mean, as anybody, any West Point grad,
yeah,
it's just a stand up.
So I mean, early on, you know, winning this appointment to West Point, actually attending West Point, you know, he was very grateful and understood the importance of having this free college education provided to him, and just took full advantage of it.
Do West Point grads go there? Do they go there for free since they serve in the military at the same or? This is a side note. Don't mean to detract yet, but
you know what? I have no idea.
Okay.
Just in my research, I don't know if they do that. I have no idea.
Yeah, I don't.
Again, any military people out there? Just
well, I know,
us.
I know. My roommate, he went to West Point. I don't know if since he was in the Army, I don't know. I'll have to ask him about that. But...
I think you enter into a contract.
Okay.
And then once you graduate West Point, you serve in the military.
So when Ike was at West Point, he did some. So he's an athletic gentleman.
Oh yeah, he was a football guy.
He's a football guy.
Love
the foosball.
And he actually played he made and played for the varsity Army football team, and really really loved the sport. However, in one of the first major hurdles in his life while attending West Point was in one game. He injured his knee badly.
Yeah.
I mean, like, really, really badly. And, this is 1911, he graduated.
Graduated in 1915.
So. And, like, back then, they didn't have, like, helmets or pads.
Oh, dude, that's right. They were, like, the leatherheads.
Yeah. I mean, it was brutal.
What the heck were we thinking?
So brutal, in fact, that Theodore Roosevelt was thinking about outlawing the sport altogether.
And Theodore Roosevelt was a big football guy too.
Yeah.
So that says a lot.
But then Theodore Roosevelt was like, well, maybe outlawing it is going a little bit too far. Yeah. So then he devised rules for it. So
rules.
Then that's where it's like you got the helmets, the pads,
yeah,
first downs, you know, all this
first downs.
Just kind of to make it safer.
Right.
Or as safe as can be.
Yeah. Right.
So he injures his knee badly, and he soon discovers, you know, weeks later that he can't play football anymore.
That's got to be a bummer.
And it bummed him out. It devastated him.
Right.
He sank into a depression. His grades slipped, and he was actually almost kicked out of West Point.
So he kind of lost his, like, purpose almost.
Yeah,
like
his
he
grades,
wanted to play football, and it his, got his, taken away from him.
Yeah, his grades were slipping. He had earned, you know, a significant amount of demerits, you know.
Yeah.
You know, just getting into trouble and stuff, and yeah,
hanging out with the bad crowd.
Yeah, well, but it was his friends that kind of helped him.
Oh, hanging out with the good crowd.
Yeah,
then.
He was hanging out with the good crowd.
Tell you what, that's the importance of friends. Have a good friend.
Friendship is magic, people.
Friendship. Friendship is magic. I'll be there for you.
And but. He soon figured out a way how he could still use his passion for football, but off the field.
Right.
So he became a junior varsity coach. He became the coach for the junior varsity football team.
Right.
And this is where, like, his natural talent for leadership kind of, like, shines through.
Yeah.
I don't think he really knew it at the time, you know?
But it's crazy how sometimes these events,
these bad
things happen, and then it like puts him in these positions where like his real, what he would be known for just comes out.
So, you know, his passion is reignited. I mean, he's not playing, but he's still able to, you know, be involved, you know, somewhat in the sport that he fell in love with.
For the love of the game.
Yeah. And turn his grades around, kind of like Patton, you know, his grades around. And then he was selected to be part, to become part of the Honor Guard.
So the Honor Guard, forgive me, is...
I'm actually not sure what that is.
Oh, you're not... You know, they did, I think that the Honor Guard would come to high school for certain things, or...
I think.
Ah, dang it. I'm not sure. But, yeah. But
we're
it was...
really, really doing an injustice to the U.S. military.
No, we don't know enough about the military. We'll have to FaceTime.
Yeah, look Will. Just look it up real quick.
I'm going to look it up. All right, anyway.
Because this is going to bug me. I feel like we're letting everybody, all the men and women in the service down right now.
But in the Honor Guard, you know, he's got a really cool quote, you know.
Well, he's a, the Honor Guard is basically like, it's like a really coveted position to have. And in it, he was tasked with carrying the American flag.
And that's big.
Yeah, that's big. And here's a quote from Eisenhower remembering his first day at West Point. When we raised our right hands and repeated the official oath, there was no confusion. A feeling came over me that the expression, the United States of America, would now and henceforth mean something different than it ever had before. From here on, it would be the nation I would be serving, not myself. Suddenly, the flag itself meant something.
So, it looks like the Honor Guard, based off what I'm pulling up right now, is for fallen comrades.
Okay.
So, like, fallen soldiers, ceremonial events.
Okay.
It seems like they're kind of the representatives of, you know, the United States, militarily speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Guardians of the colors. Have you ever seen this? I feel like I've seen this at certain points. It's not, I don't think it's just for funerals, but it's...
Don't they like guard the tombs?
That is the tomb of the unknown soldier.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's a whole nother thing.
Yeah, that's a whole nother
thing. But so that quote, he really like, you know, it's really powerful because, you know, when you think about the United States and taking pride in one's country...
Uh-huh.
That's what that quote just speaks volumes to me. You know, I really recognized holding that flag that it was no longer about me.
Yeah.
You know, it's about the country, the nation, it's about us, you know, not me, but we.
Yeah.
You know,
and it takes on another meaning, especially, you know, when you're in the military.
Of course.
Like he was attending West Point, you know, but he still had that patriotism.
Yeah.
You know, so.
And you got so many famous West Point grads even.
Oh, yeah.
Before, I mean, you got Robert E. Lee, mm-hmm. Ulysses S. Grant, pretty much every general in the Civil War.
Yeah, basically.
Went to West Point.
Like Patton.
Patton.
It was just really a prestigious
place.
It still is a prestigious place.
Yeah. Very prestigious.
So, you know, but it just kind of helped. You know, you're talking about, you know, he's coming from, you know, poor family, you know, born in Texas, grows up in Abilene, Kansas.
Yeah.
And then he wins his appointment at West Point, and like his purpose.
Yeah.
Kind of like unfolds, you know, his first day at West Point.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, this is.
Kind of sparks a military career.
Yeah, this is coming up. This is what I'm going to do.
I'm going to serve my country for my life.
Yeah, despite, you know, his mother protesting it.
Yeah. Can't go against, you know, I'll tell you what, going against the mother's will is pretty powerful.
Strong, yeah. But due to his knee injury, he never really, throughout Eisenhower's military service, he never saw active combat, though.
Oh, he didn't?
No.
Oh.
He was supposed to go to combat in... so, anyway, he graduates 64th in his class out of 164 on June 11th, 1915.
Nice.
Then he was stationed in San Antonio, Texas, where he met his future wife, Mimi.
Okay. Mamie Geneva?
Yeah.
Dowd?
And, yeah. And the couple married in 1916 and later had two sons, Dowd Dwight and John. And, okay. Dowd Dwight passed away at an early age from scarlet fever.
Oh, man.
And
that's tragic.
Yeah, Eisenhower never served in World War One. The war ended before he got called up for service to go serve in Europe.
Okay. So how did he get his appointment for World War II as being Supreme Allied Commander?
I think he was just chosen.
Just chosen? I pick you.
But, you know, let's wrap up his thing. So, you know, but despite not having served in World War One, which is kind of another bummer,
yeah,
for him. You know, you go to West Point, you get all that training, and
you get a chance to serve your country in the war.
Patriot, you know, you get that inspirational patriotism, and you know, then right. You can't figure out, you know, the war is over,
right?
You know, you kind of have a little bit of discouragement, you know,
yeah.
Resentment towards yourself, you know, why did I have to go injure my knee in football, you know, and
right
all this other stuff. But between, you know, World Wars One and Two, he managed to get another appointment to attend the Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas.
Okay, gotcha.
And again, he graduated first of his class. Not again, but he graduated first of his class out of 254.
Yikes.
And served as aide to General John J. Pershing, and then later to Douglas MacArthur for 7 years stationed in the Philippines.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So he was stationed in the Philippines for a while.
Yep.
With old Doug.
Old Doug MacArthur.
Old Dougie.
Dugart.
Dugart. Big Dugart.
But, you know, he returned to the United States shortly after Germany attacked Poland.
Right. And then that's when declarations of war were
popping off. And then prior to Pearl Harbor in September 1941, Eisenhower received a promotion to 1-star brigadier general.
Okay.
Now, when he was with MacArthur, he was a lieutenant colonel.
Okay, gotcha.
So he received a promotion and becomes a 1-star.
So he works his way up the line.
Yeah.
Or the rankings.
Yep.
Become one of the main characters.
Yeah.
Leading the conflict in World War II in Europe.
Yeah, and then after Pearl Harbor, Ike was called to Washington D.C. to work as a planning officer. So basically, like, what that means is, like, you plan out operations for, in his case, for the European theater. And one of the first operations that he helped plan was Operation Torch, which was...
Oh, he did do that.
The Allied invasion of North Africa.
Wow. And another operation that was the big one, Operation Overlord.
Yeah. Operation Overlord. Well, and then after Operation Torch, he directed the amphibious invasion of Sicily.
Oh, he did the invasion of Sicily, too.
And the invasion of the Italian peninsula in 1943. But by 1944, Rome had been captured by the Allies.
Okay, so...
That's pretty much wrapped up.
Right.
But, like you said, the big...
Sorry, I feel like I'm getting ahead of myself.
You're getting ahead.
Sorry.
Pump your brakes, kid. So, but yeah, the big operation.
The big one. So, from what I know
about
Operation Overlord is it wasn't an easy thing to plan. This was years in the making.
Yes.
We had been planning this for quite some time. This was going to be it.
Yeah,
you know, this was the big invasion. We're invading mainland France. How do we do this?
And the thing is that the Germans knew that there was an invasion coming.
They did, but they didn't know where. And there were some pretty interesting information out there about that whole planning process, and, you know, especially deciding where to go, using Patton as a decoy. I mean, it was like there was a lot that went into that invasion. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That a lot of behind the scenes work.
Yeah. Like for months leading up to the attack, you know, diversions and misinformation and, you know.
And the thing was, though, that the longer, see, this was a chaotic thing to plan, because the longer you waited, the more you risked Nazis, Germany finding out more information, planning more, preparing. I mean, I know Hitler, what was he like setting up fortifications all along the French coast at a lot of areas.
He put Erwin Rommel in charge of the fortifications.
Okay.
That's, I think...
the Desert Fox.
Yeah, Desert Fox finding himself in France. Kind of like, you know, PO'd that Hitler didn't listen to him sooner. But hey, it's Hitler. He was on drugs.
But hey, he was on meth. Can you blame him?
Yeah. But yeah, so he's in charge of the defense, but they don't know where it's coming from. A lot of deception, you know. Patton's on the other side of the Isle Channel in England, fuming.
Yeah, waiting to get his shot, because he's been kind of benched for this whole operation.
Yeah, and we talked about it in the Patton episode. You know.
Yeah, if you haven't listened to that, go check it out.
But Ike was furious with him because he slapped two soldiers with PTSD back right. Then it was known as battle fatigue.
So not only does he have, so on top of all the things he's trying to plan, this he cannot use his most talented general in the operation.
Yeah,
so he's got to go forward without it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you want to say anything about the D-Day invasion, but you know, I know that we talked about how even before the preparation,
mm-hmm.
he had written
two letters. Yeah, the first letter goes, "You are about to embark upon a great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck." Now, the second letter...
Good luck! And that was like a encouragement letter.
Yeah. The second letter that he wrote was in case it failed. Because, you know, like you pointed out, we don't have our best general.
Yeah. You know,
Germans are expecting our best general.
A lot can go wrong.
And a lot can go wrong. And in the second letter, our landings in the... God, I wish I spoke French.
Chorburg, Havre
area have failed to gain a satisfactory foothold, and I have withdrawn the troops. My decision to attack at this time and place was based upon the best information available. The troops, the air, and the navy did all that bravery and devotion to duty could do. If any blame or fault attaches to the attempt, it is mine alone. So this shows that, you know, he wasn't really sure if it was going to be successful leading up to D-Day. They were dealing with bad weather.
Yeah, the weather. That was the English Channel. My gosh, was that choppy.
Yeah.
Some choppy water. Not a place you want to go skiing in the summertime.
But it was on June 5th, you know, that that D-Day was supposed to happen, but it was delayed because of bad weather. And then his meteorologists came to him with predictions of favorable weather on June 6th.
Jim Ganahl came down to Europe.
Dude, I swear, meteorologists are like seers, like modern-day seers, because like they say it's about science. It's not about science. they're just making stuff up.
They're just making stuff up. No, well the thing is, like he, I mean, when's the last time we had a leader that
admitted he was ready
to admit fault?
Yeah,
had prepared a letter. Someone is so committed to his country, they were willing to bear the shame and to bear the burden of a botched operation.
Yeah,
you know. And the thing about Ike was that he was so ready to take on full commitment. He recognized he is the leader. You know, the leader gets blamed no matter what.
No matter what. Yeah.
And he made several attempts to go out, boost morale.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talked about, Jake and I have talked before about Ulysses S. Grant and how sometimes the presence of a leader can boost the morale.
Yeah.
You know, you're about to have the most insane day tomorrow and you have no idea if you're going to make it or how it's going to go.
And Eisenhower, he understood the importance of this, but he would also later, you know, when he was in his presidency, he would make quotes or quotes, comments on leadership. And he said, you know, sometimes, you know, me making those visits to the front line encouraged me.
Yeah.
You know, of any kind of shortcomings or resentments that I was dealing with, just to be able to go out there and just my presence alone is able to boost morale, kind of boosted my morale. So
that's incredible.
He saw it as like a give, you know?
Yeah.
And,
he got something from it as well.
And the American, troops that were fighting just gave him reassurance that, you know, he was doing the right thing, that he was doing everything possible to ensure the end of this war with, you know.
Yeah. Like the worst enemy we could ever.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing was also about this decision was it was like it wasn't 100% success. You know, there wasn't a for sure we're going to invade and we're going to have a success, you know?
Yeah.
It was like a gamble. He was like, oh gosh, we got this window. Mm-hmm. If we wait, then the Germans are going to find out. But if we go now, there's a risk that we'll get, the weather won't be good. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh gosh, you know, we got to just go now. I remember I was watching a documentary one time and they had a video of like in the boardroom, they had like a meeting of like whether they're not going to go or not. And he just like, it's just like a awkward silence. And then he's just like, let's go.
Yeah.
It's like, he's like, let's just go.
Yeah.
Like, let's do it. And
yeah, we got,
and we did it and we did it and we made it and all is well.
Yeah. So at a great cost,
at an insane amount of loss of life. What is it? One of the largest landborne invasions or seaborne invasions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In U.S. history, at least.
Yeah.
Yep.
And
it cost us for sure.
It did, you know. And, yeah.
Yeah.
So the success of D-Day, you know, is, I can only imagine, a really good feeling to Eisenhower.
Right.
A sense of relief, but bittersweet, you know, to him.
Yeah.
A sense of relief, but also a sense of, my God, you know, look at how many, you know, American troops died.
Making this thing possible. And a lot more were going to die.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the thing about these wars sometimes, especially World War II. Most casualties overall, like from every country, most casualties in any other war
that
the U.S. has been a part of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the loss of life was extraordinary, and we won that war at incredible cost. I mean, it cost us a lot.
Yeah.
And that's another thing that goes into the decision process, like, dude, how many? I mean, yeah, okay. Say we do make it past the German line, mm-hmm. and get off the beach. What? I mean, how many people are we expecting are gonna die doing this thing?
Or even like, how many people do we project are going? How many casualties are we gonna have? You know, during Operation Overlord.
Right.
You know.
They were pretty dug in, especially Omaha. You know, Mm-hmm. A lot of people, when they think about D-Day, they think about Omaha Beach. Felt some of the most stiff resistance. Mm-hmm. Lots of lives lost. You know, we've talked about Greg's dad.
Yeah.
Did Utah Beach.
On Utah Beach.
Found, you know, and even Utah Beach compared to Omaha was a lot less stiff resistance. They were able to mm-hmm. break through. But even on Utah Beach, I know one time Greg said that his dad was like, after that day, the fact that I was still alive,
yeah,
I didn't take anything else for granted after that day.
Yeah,
you know, and you can only imagine.
It's kind of hard to take things for granted after a dozen Germans with MG-42s try to pump you full of holes.
seriously. I mean, so, you know, a decision that not many people could have made, honestly.
Yeah.
To move forward with it.
I think so, too.
But even in that letter, he states he waited until he had all. And that's the one thing you got to take away from this is you make the decision with as much information that is available to you. You make the best choice with the limited information that you have.
Yeah.
You know, the weather, the secrecy of the operation mm-hmm. being compromised. Like in that, the thing about Eisenhower that I've heard is like, he was very he heard from everybody, you know, he let everybody talk. Even when he was president, he let the Democrats talk. He let the Republicans talk. We all formulated a plan together. I hear your information and I hear your information based on everything that I've got. Mm-hmm. He's very open-minded, you know, based on everything I got, this is the decision we're going to make.
Yeah.
So with that.
Yeah. He was able to talk to everybody in the room, process the information given, but still decisive enough to come to his own conclusion based off of the information and make a decisive decision, despite if people agreed with it or not.
Exactly. Well put.
Yeah. So Ike's invasion on D-Day led to the liberation of Paris, which marked the turning point for the Allies. They were now on the offensive.
Yeah.
You know,
race to Berlin.
The Germans were on the defensive, and it really became a race to Berlin. But the war ended with, obviously, the Russian Red Army taking Berlin.
Right.
But this sparked outrage amongst the American media.
Oh, really?
Because Ike ordered the armies under his command to stop at the Elbe River
and not go to Berlin.
But
what was the thinking behind that?
Okay, well, first Eisenhower and others defended Eisenhower's actions, you know, in doing so.
Okay.
So one was that the Russians were closer and had more troops.
Right. Which is surprising.
Yeah.
it's an incredible feat that the fact that any Russian survived that war after all that they lost.
And then two, Berlin had been promised to the Russians at the Yalta Conference in February of 1945.
Was that the one with like Churchill and...
And basically what that conference was basically, in summary, it was a conference that the Allies held to basically come up with post-war plans on how they were going to divide up Germany.
Oh, so we pretty much had it in the bag.
Yeah.
We just needed to know.
We needed to know what we were going to do after, and Berlin was promised to the Russians, and, you know. Gosh. Yeah. So they took it.
And that turned into a catastrophe.
Yeah.
So what, the Russians got half, they got East Germany and we got West Germany along with the British.
Yeah, and then it was like divvied up, the rest was divvied up between Britain and France. You know, the term that comes to mind, or the quote that comes to mind, is "Till the victor goes to spoils."
Right.
So they're just carving it up like a pie.
Carving it up, chopping it up.
Like an apple pie.
Chopping it up like an apple pie, baby.
Everybody gets a piece.
Everyone gets a slice.
Now, Eisenhower also, you know, after the war in Europe ended, we still had to fight Japan.
Yeah, that's
true.
And
Eisenhower vocally expressed his opinion why we shouldn't have dropped the atomic bomb.
Oh, so he was
against it.
The thing that it just blows my brains when we talk about the atom bomb is like, you're like I remember sitting in social studies class, like they asked us that question. We're like in like 15. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, drop the bomb. No, no, but like you would think all the generals, all the people in the war, you would think that they would want to drop the bomb.
Yeah.
Eisenhower didn't want to drop the bomb. Nimitz didn't want to drop the bomb. Mm-hmm. And MacArthur didn't want to drop the bomb.
Yeah.
All for different reasons.
Yeah. MacArthur, it was ego. For Nimitz and Eisenhower,
was it ethics?
Yeah, kind
or
of.
Or
a little bit.
Morality of it all?
Morals, I guess. Their morals.
They didn't. You know? I know one thing. They didn't think they needed to.
Yeah, because they thought Japan was beaten.
Japan was already hardly limping along.
But you know. But then you know you go to. You know, you ask a U.S. Marine in World War II. You know,
they're like, "Is it even going to work?"
Well,
is that where you're going?
Well, where I was going with it was if you were to go back in time and ask a U.S. Marine, you know, fighting in the Pacific, they would be like, there's the only way to end this war is we just have to kill them all.
Right, right.
You know, we're fighting over scraps of these islands.
They're just like...
That nobody has ever heard of back in America.
And the Japanese are fighting over it like it's...
Like it's Japan.
Tokyo.
Yeah. So... You know, mixed crowd. And that's kind of what weighed on Truman's mind, you know, is the sheer cost. Because in his mind, it's like, okay, well...
He had the ultimate decision.
Yeah, he's like, okay, yeah, well, we can invade Japan, but how many more American lives are going to be taken?
Right. I mean, we're talking...
I mean, we're seeing...
People, we are talking invasion of Africa, invasion of Italy,
yeah,
invasion... of France. And then the war literally ends with a bang.
Mm-hmm.
With
then
more people dead.
Germany. Yeah. And then, you know, so, you know, if you're President Truman and you got this option, you know.
Right. So what was the idea behind him? Just didn't think
Eisenhower
it was necessary?
Eisenhower just believed that the Japanese were already beaten. I also think it goes back to his Mennonite roots, you know.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, Mennonite, if you're growing up Mennonite, yeah, and you have the decision to drop an atom bomb,
yeah,
I'll tell you what, I don't think they're going to choose the bomb, I'm going to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I think that's just a guess, but I think I stand pretty firm on that.
So
I don't think any Mennonite's dropping an atomic bomb.
So, yeah, so after the war in 1948, Eisenhower leaves active duty in the U.S. Army and briefly becomes the president of Columbia University.
Ayo. In Chicago?
Where is
New York? Oh, New York, New York.
New York. I think that...
Unique New York. Unique New York. Yeah, they got a couple campuses.
Yeah, so, they have a couple campuses.
Right, right.
I think they have one in New York and one in Chicago.
One in Chicago, yeah.
But I think the mother campus is in New York.
Gotcha.
But Eisenhower only stayed in civilian life for a short time.
Couldn't take it. I'm just kidding.
Well, no.
Oh,
it wasn't that.
I was just kidding.
Before, in 1950, was asked by President Truman to take command of NATO forces in Europe, so that NATO forces could combat communist aggression around the world.
So that was the thing. After World War II, it was like, now we got a whole nother can of worms. We got communism.
Because basically after World War II, there was this thing known as the Berlin Airlift.
Right.
And it was basically a competition between the United States and Russia. Because, you know, Germany is destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a pile of rubble. You know, who can send the most aid to rebuild Germany?
Right.
With the idea being, if we can help them rebuild and give them aid to rebuild,
right,
then we can push our ideology.
Right, right.
For the U.S., it was capitalism. For Russians, it was communism.
Communism, the gospel of envy, as Churchill put it.
Yeah.
So,
So he's put in charge of the NATO forces just to contain communism as much as it can.
Right.
Because there's this theory of like a domino effect. If one country falls to communism,
right, exactly,
another country will fall to communism, yeah, and another one, and then another one, and another one, and another one, so on and so forth. And so that was the ideology, or not the ideology, but the theory.
Yeah. It's interesting how after the Civil War, you know, you got Ulysses S. Grant tasked with reconstruction of the South,
mm-hmm,
also fighting off different ideologies.
Yeah. And so he does that for like two years. But by 1952, President Truman was not a very popular guy. We were at war with Korea because, again, we're trying to slow communists.
Right.
Aggression, you know, North Korea was communist, South Korea didn't want to be communist, so
yeah,
we went to war.
So people weren't really into the whole Korean War,
no.
Or Vietnam,
because
did we just not understand why we were fighting those wars?
I don't think a lot of people did,
because it was very apparent.
In my humble opinion, you know, this is 1952,
right.
We just got out of
a pretty serious war.
A pretty bloody war in World War II. Why are we jumping into another one?
Yeah. In
you know,
the
who cares about communism, you know?
Right.
Why are we getting involved in, you know?
Yeah.
Because for many years, you know, before World War I and World War II, America practiced isolationism. Like, we're just going to take care of America.
Right.
The rest of the world.
Now we're dipping our hands in
everything. Now we're dipping our hands in everything because, you know, the U.S. government is competing with the Soviet government to, you know, spread their influence around the globe.
It's so crazy, man. You see it in everything. You saw it in all the movies, in all the, I mean, Rocky.
Yeah.
You know, Bobby Fischer and the Miracle on Lake Placid. Mm-hmm. It was the Russians. The Russians were the bad guys.
Yeah.
Every movie, literally every movie back then, who's the bad guy? It's the Russians. Guy. It's the Russian.
You know, and then you got the space race, you know, Yuri Gagarin, first man in space, then John Glenn, first man to orbit Earth.
John Glenn International Airport, Columbus, Ohio.
Oh yeah, baby.
John Glenn's a Ohio native.
Yeah. And then you have, you know, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin,
walking
on the first people to walk on the moon. So there was just this great competition.
Right, right.
You know, to win the world, basically.
Win the total world domination.
Yeah.
And the whole nuclear threat. Not
yes,
to mention
the nuclear threat too. So, Truman's popularity is not doing so well, and leading Republicans approach Eisenhower and manage to persuade him to run for president.
Okay.
And then later that year, at the RNC, Eisenhower wins the Republican nomination overwhelming majority.
Really?
Yeah. And the slogan "I like Ike" is adopted.
I like Ike. So if you think Michael Jordan came up with the whole "Like Mike" slogan, I'll tell you what, I'm thinking Ike. It was before it was "Be Like Mike." It was "Be Like Ike."
Yeah, and then Eisenhower.
Yeah. Anyway. No.
Yeah. Anyway, glossing over that useless information, Eisenhower picked Richard Nixon as his running mate, and together they won the presidential election, and Eisenhower became the 34th president of the United States. And Richard Nixon served as his vice president.
Very interesting. I did not know that.
I did not know that either until researching it. And we all know what Nixon did.
Yeah, that decision didn't age well.
Yeah. Well, he was Eisenhower had passed away long before.
Oh, he did.
Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Well, his political career was fairly successful.
Yes, so especially his presidency. So Eisenhower was a moderate Republican, and, you know, by moderate, you're kind of more open-minded. Your political party is just your political party.
Like, right, right. But doesn't mean that there's not any leeway with...
Yeah, with, like, bipartisanship.
Because I think we mentioned earlier that the Democrats controlled the House at that time?
Yeah, at that time they controlled... you know, most of Congress, and, you know. So, but throughout his presidency, he won great legislative battles.
Right.
One of the popular things that Eisenhower did was he continued the New Deal and the Fair Deal.
Okay.
Which were championed by his predecessors, the New
FDR.
Deal, FDR, and then the Fair Deal was Truman.
Yeah.
He ended the war in Korea, expanded Social Security, increased minimum wage, and created the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare.
Hey.
And then in 1956, he created the Interstate Highway System, which became one of the largest public works projects in American history. And consisted of 41,000 miles of road across the country.
And that says a lot, given the fact that we did the Transcontinental Railroad.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the reason why the interstate highway system was kind of like pushed through is because, you know, at this time, there are like growing nuclear fears.
Right, right, right.
So if you have an interstate highway system, you can, you know, and everybody's thinking like Russia's going to invade us.
Yeah, we, like, we
they'll, got... They'll you know, launch a nuke, and then they'll invade, you know.
Yeah.
So the idea behind the interstate highway system is so we can move troops and military assets quickly across the nation. So
pretty crazy.
Yeah. Luckily, that didn't happen.
Luckily.
Yeah.
Almost did.
Yeah. And then in addition... Ike signed the Civil Rights Bill of 1957.
Hey, yo.
However, Congress amended the bill and severely limited its effectiveness, much to Eisenhower's dismay.
Oh, because then they did do the Civil Rights Act of 1964, I'm pretty sure, which was the big one.
Yeah, that was the one that...
like, completely outlawed.
Stuck, yeah.
Yeah, like, all discrimination.
Because, I mean, it's 1957. Civil rights is not a very popular issue.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, Congress was kind of like doing everything that they could to subvert and stuff like that. But Ike was a proponent for civil rights. He ended up getting the Civil Rights Bill of 1957 passed, but Congress meddled with it, and he kind of was a little upset with Congress. Like, why?
Yeah. Yeah. Put all that work through for nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. And he balanced the budget three times.
I'll tell you what, if you learned anything from this guy did it all.
Yeah.
This guy did it all. Leader, general, accountant.
Yeah, man.
Balanced the books.
One of Ike's greatest accomplishments as president was that he kept America at peace despite the Cold War.
Yeah.
You know,
crises
around the world.
Right, right.
And, however...
Hey, man, you put a Mennonite as president. We're not getting involved in anything.
Yeah, well, hang on. However, because by this time, the CIA is formed.
Oh, we just do it in the shadows.
Mm-hmm. And Eisenhower utilized the CIA and authorized them to conduct covert operations...
What?
...around the globe to stop the spread of communism.
Dude, what was that? Why do we not... I feel like I don't know a whole lot about the CIA. We got to do a pod on the CIA.
Yeah, well, they kept it. They had to keep it secret.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. I don't know a whole lot about it because I feel like it was so top secret.
Yes. Well,
all that stuff's got to be declassified.
Nobody.
By now, right?
Yeah, yeah, but nobody could talk about it.
Hush, hush.
Yeah, it had to be hush, hush. It had to be.
You're not a Russian spy, are you, Jake?
No. Oh, speaking of which, Eisenhower also did come into contact with Joseph John McCarthy.
Who? Joseph John McCarthy?
No, his first name is either Joseph. I think his name is John McCarthy.
Okay.
Anyway, doesn't really matter. The guy was a paranoid senator that thought that, you know, basically had that there were communist sleeper agents.
In the U.S.
In the United States.
Oh, wow.
Was really paranoid, and Ike kind of didn't really like him because...
Well, he's probably like freaking everyone out.
Yeah, because he's like freaking everybody out, and he's like, dude, like, relax, man.
Dude, chill. Okay.
Chill.
I was in World War II, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
Chill out.
Yeah, his name's Joseph McCarthy.
Joseph McCarthy.
And basically,
sit down, Joseph.
He led this... anti-communist crusade that, you know, as a result of his paranoia about communists being in America, it violated a lot of civil liberties for citizens.
Right.
And, yeah, which led to hearings. And Eisenhower, being Eisenhower, didn't publicly criticize McCarthy, but privately he was like, this dude is nuts.
So
like,
so he did have some political rivals.
Yeah.
You would say.
Yeah.
Cool.
And the Civil Rights Act of 1957 was the first act to be passed since Reconstruction.
But, since Reconstruction concerning rights of African Americans.
Yeah. And then back to the CIA point, I just kind of want to point this out. So, like I said, Eisenhower authorizes covert operations around the globe. And two of those operations toppled the governments of Iran in 1953 and Guatemala in 1954.
What?
So, yeah. So, even though...
He's everywhere.
Yeah. So, even though he's doing his best to keep us out of another war, because he knows the American public does not want that.
Right.
He still understands that there's this threat
of
communist aggression, and we need to deal with it. But, you know, let's just use the CIA, and we'll keep it off the books, you know. and nobody's got to know about it.
Brilliant.
You know, it's like you're in the mob. You got two books, you know.
Right,
one
right.
One legit, one fake.
One legit and then one that's cooking.
Yeah, one that's cooking. You got so you can cook the books.
So the CIA was his way of getting around another war but still keeping communism at bay and keeping the threats to America to a minimum.
Yeah, and especially keeping the tensions, the threats to America minimal, and also the tensions with Russia minimal on good standing and too.
Right.
So, and this is something that Eisenhower was really wanting to do, was improve relations with Russia. And then in 1953, Joseph Stalin dies. So he sees this as like an opening. Like, okay, they're crazy.
And they knew by now that Joseph Stalin was a psychopath, right? Or was it still?
It was kind of like an iron curtain. We had no
idea. The iron curtain?
We had no idea what was going on.
Nothing.
Yeah.
We were partnered with a Darth Vader of the time.
Yeah.
And we didn't
Darth Vader.
A Russian Darth Vader, if you can believe that.
But in July of 1955, the U.S., British, French, and Russian leaders met in Geneva, Switzerland to discuss, you know, East-West relations. And this is where Eisenhower proposed his open skies policy, which would allow for the U.S. and Russia to conduct air inspections of each other's military strength.
Really?
Now, the USSR rejected this proposal.
Yeah, I wouldn't imagine that would go over well.
But the international community praised Eisenhower for this approach.
So look.
Which is basically like saying like that was a way for us to like get behind the Iron Curtain and see what was going on.
Yeah, and they're like, yeah, not so fast.
Yeah, we don't like here in Mother Russia, we like our privacy.
We like Well, the thing is, dude, he's killing it on the not only on the domestic front, but on the foreign policy, on civil relationships, preventing a World War III, and winning World War II as a general.
Yeah.
The guy is just
the guy's doing everything. And then, you know, as nuclear weapons technology becomes, you know, more and more of an increasing threat.
Right.
Eisenhower still managed to strengthen NATO and created the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization to slow communist expansion in the region.
Okay.
And that helped us stay out of Vietnam.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He also proposed the Eisenhower Doctrine.
Wow.
Which basically was a doctrine saying that America could provide aid to foreign nations that requested it.
Yeah.
Again, to slow the spread of communism. So
he's got a laundry list of achievements in office.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we can go on and on talking about
on and on and on
all that stuff.
And, you know, throughout his presidency, he enjoyed great approval ratings.
Wow.
He did have a lot of opposition, you know, because
as all great men do.
Yeah, he was a, you know, he was a moderate Republican. Like, yes, he was with the Republican Party, but kind of like was like not like a hard-lined
right-winger. Right, right. Like he would even disagree with, yeah. like he would have some disagreements with yeah. Republicans.
Yeah. But, you know, wasn't left-wing, you know, just kind of like a down the middle
yeah.
kind of person. And yeah, so, you know, he kept us out of war, kept the U.S.-Soviet relations friendly. But he wanted to sign a treaty with Russia before he left office. But then the American U-2 spy plane was shot down over Russia.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, the whole Gary Powers.
Yeah, was he the one in the plane?
He was
and
the one
in
the
got...
plane.
He got captured.
Shot down, captured.
Oh, my gosh.
And then it was, like, televised.
Dang, man, that's yeah. not good.
And if you've ever seen the movie...
Bridge of Spies,
that's what it's about.
You remember when he's in that courtroom?
Yeah.
The way they shot that courtroom scene mm-hmm. and he's surrounded by red...
Yeah.
And, like, Russian-speaking people, and he's like, what the heck is going on?
Yeah. Yeah. Kept in a gulag and tortured.
Was he tortured, really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man, for, like, U.S. information.
Yeah.
Ugh.
About what was going on, and he couldn't.
And they ended up doing, what, a prison exchange?
Yeah. Because in the movie, they gave him, like, this silver dollar, but inside of it was, like, a cyanide capsule.
Oh.
So he could take it, you know, but he didn't get the chance to do that before he was captured.
Yeah, free falling out of an airplane is not a good time to yeah. grab your cyanide
yeah,
capsule.
The, like top of the stress. Yeah. Anyway, so that didn't happen, you know, and then his term was up. And so in January of 1961, Eisenhower gives his farewell address to the nation.
Right.
And in this farewell address, he mentions, he warns Americans of what he called the military-industrial complex.
Okay.
And basically, he was worried that the combination of national defense needs and the advances in technology would build a partnership between the United States military and big business.
Really?
Yeah. And would, you know, because as the threats increase, military spending increases, then these big companies...
start
know,
making bank on
come in you know to build these weapons and make bank on them. And he said that was like it would have an undue threat or an undue influence over the American government itself.
Wow, that's interesting. So basically explain that a little bit. So I'm having a hard time understanding. So basically when we would get into like a conflict or something,
mm-hmm.
like big business would come in and take advantage of.
Yeah, we never had that in World War II.
Okay.
We just had like the war bonds, which was basically celebrities would tour around with
okay.
U.S. soldiers to raise money, and it was all charitable donations.
Yeah.
You know, so that, you know, buy a war bond and put a bullet in your best buddy's gun. You know,
oh,
stuff like
but,
that.
But then they were trying to do more.
But then, you know, after World War II, we see, you know, companies, you know, being.
Is this being now? Correct me if I'm wrong. This could be either stupid or on track. Is this kind of how the big business has privatized space exploration like how they've kind of stepped in and taken over like a governmental organization like NASA.
Yeah. Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah.
Or capitalized on that opportunity,
you know, cause it gives rise. It was just a concern of his because, you know, and I guess you can see this today are what are known as paramilitary companies.
Okay. Okay.
Which are private companies that hire ex-soldiers that provide security.
Oh.
in a hostile region, but don't answer to the U.S. government.
Okay, so it's kind of, it basically, in a way, in a nutshell, it's kind of like civilian business stepping in on governmental issues,
on governmental spend. Yeah,
governmental spending. Yeah, and that can be problematic.
Yeah.
Okay. So
because then we don't, you know, nobody votes for anything,
right?
You know, it's just kind of like, well, you want more U2s built? Well, my company can help.
Yeah. Okay. It kind of deunifies, I would say, the government in a way.
Yeah, it just diminishes it.
Yeah, diminishes the governmental power, especially in wartime.
I mean, yeah, because you have contracts now. I think they were able to work it out.
Okay.
Because now we have the private sector and.
America
will give out a contract. Yeah, so. Right. I don't know exactly how it worked. I'm just a historian.
I'm just
telling you what he said. I don't know.
But his farewell address is really, really powerful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so do you have that on you?
Yes, I do.
Do you mind giving the people a little bit of that farewell address? Because
I'm not going to read the whole thing.
Right.
If you want to read the whole thing, go to pbs.org, The American Experience, and there's an article, Eisenhower's Farewell Address, 1961.
Okay.
But this is like at the beginning of the speech, which I found pretty... Hang on a second. Let me think. Because there might...
I mean that's just the thing about Eisenhower, you know. I mean, he really left a mark, left an impact, and I just feel like in this farewell address he just really sums up his career in a lot of ways.
Yeah. So this is. Here's about going back to his warning. This is what he says. In it. A vital element in keeping the peace is our military establishment. Our arms must be mighty, ready for instant action, so that no potential aggressor may be tempted to risk his own destruction. Our military organization today bears little relation to that known of any of my predecessors in peacetime, nor, indeed, by the fighting men of World War II or Korea. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of snowplows could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But now we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent arms industry for vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security more than the net income of all the United States corporations. This conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the experience, in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize that the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought by the military-industrial complex. The potential for a disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. Okay. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals so that security and liberty may prosper together.
Dang.
Yeah.
Good job, man. That's a mouthful.
Yeah.
So basically he's kind of outlining a lot of that kind of stuff, that military complex kind of things. And
that warning. Yeah. Because he thought it could influence, you know.
Yeah. I never knew that.
Hold sway. But his warning goes on, it falls on deaf ears.
Right.
Because, you know, the Cold War is like, by the time Kennedy comes into the presidency, the Cold War is going hot.
It's, yeah. the Cold War is heating up a bit.
It's gone hot. So,
yeah, it almost comes to the brink of nuclear warfare.
Yeah. And, you know, and even though, you know, Eisenhower's presidency faced, you know, criticism from time to time by both Republicans and Democrats, you know, he still managed to lead the country and do what he needed to do.
Yeah, and I really think that that's pretty special. You know, I think that it's been a while since we had a leader like Eisenhower,
mm-hmm.
someone who's willing to take responsibility for his actions,
yeah.
do decisive planning from learning all the information from both parties and then making a decision.
Yeah.
And even we didn't even touch on it, his decision through the Holocaust, you know, when they walked up on those camps, he's like, we need to get some people to document this
mm-hmm.
ASAP so this thing does not happen ever again.
Yes.
And so that we can know that this is what's going on over here.
Mm-hmm.
Hitler is controlling groups of the Jewish population,
killing them,
doing a mass genocide.
Yeah.
And just even his decision making and all that is mm-hmm. something to really study and admire about.
Yeah.
About his character.
Yeah.
So without further ado.
And then, you know, after he leaves office, Eisenhower retired to his farm in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, where he lived out the rest of his life until his death on March 28th, 1969.
Wow.
And he died of congestive heart failure.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
Man.
But yeah, great, great president. Anyway, but as always, we like to end
with a little bit of burning questions.
Burning questions. We kind of forgot to do our icebreakers. So, but
well, I didn't really have much of an icebreaker, yeah, really, but as much either, as, but I mean, I got one burning question right off the bat. Ching, ching, ching.
Yo, let's go burn questions.
Bing, bing, bang. So, hey. Operation Overlord fails. What do we got? Are we done?
Oh, boy.
We're done, right?
No, I wouldn't say done.
It's over, right?
No, I would just say major setback.
We'd rally, though.
You know, Eisenhower would have taken full responsibility for it.
That's the beautiful thing.
But we would have rallied.
Yeah.
And, you know,
people didn't even know he was writing a letter. Again.
Yeah. Nobody knew that. Nobody knew he wrote a second letter.
Nobody knew he wrote a second letter.
No.
But he did.
He did.
And he was, that just goes to show he was so ready.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing is, I was watching that documentary of the 101st Airborne, and he's like, I looked outside the plane, and I didn't realize how, like, that's when I realized how massive this invasion was.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
When I looked out of the plane, saw all the ships, all the guys, like, what the, what?
Yeah,
say
you can,
what?
You can find pictures.
Yeah, pictures. I mean, it's insane. It's I mean, it's almost like going back to like Roman times.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there was some that was like a biblical proportions invasion.
Unleash hell.
Yeah. Launching the catapult. I mean, that was some like ancient conflict right there.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Easy.
Yeah. Okay. That's enough.
Yeah.
So that's one of my burning questions. Did you have a burning question?
My burning question is,
thinking out, dwell on it, take your time.
Do, do, do.
Oh, by the way, if anyone wants to check out all our past episodes, the Low Bros History Podcast .buzzsprout.com
mm-hmm.
And also we just started a new blog
Oh yeah,
we're posting blogs now. We're writing. We're putting the pen to pad, and we're dishing you something interesting. Kind of tags along with some of the stuff we talk about. Gives you a little bit more insight. Focuses on a certain topic. Yeah. Check it out. TheLowBrosHistoryBlog.com.
Yep. So. Actually, I can't really think of any burning questions.
Okay. Well, you know, the one thing that I really had was what if we didn't succeed in the invasion?
Yeah.
And also, I mean, what can we apply to our life about Eisenhower, in your opinion?
In my opinion, it's just what we can apply is... It takes a lot of time, experience, and studying to be a great leader.
Yeah.
When you're walking into the Oval Office or walking into a boardroom or, you know, walking into a classroom, you know, check your ego at the door and keep an open mind and, you know, listen to everybody.
Yeah.
But also don't be afraid to make your own decisions. Because you can't worry about the people that disagree with you. You just gotta move forward.
Yeah, I think for me, Eisenhower was one of the last really great leaders, especially of the United States, that was more concerned with maintaining the unity that is the United States at more than just being right.
Yeah.
You know, he was more concerned with keeping the country intact. And even if that meant sacrificing his own ego, he wasn't an ego guy. And the thing is, we've talked about these World War II leaders. They're all different. They all led so differently.
Yeah.
You know, Nimitz, very, very team-oriented, supportive. Mm-hmm. Patton, very strong-willed and aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
And Eisenhower is just like the master magician of this whole...
Yeah.
Of the whole epic of World War II, you know?
Yeah.
So... With that, I mean,
God love him. I like Ike. I don't know about you.
I like Ike. I'd vote for Ike today.
Yeah, I'd vote for him.
He's got my vote.
Yeah. If only we had just like taken him and frozen him or something.
Yeah, we need to clone. We need to clone Ike.
Yeah.
That's the only time it would be ethically.
Well, maybe not clone him.
No,
maybe not clone him.
Just kidding.
But maybe I don't know.
Right.
Do some like.
Do some kind of Gattaca genetic engineering thing.
Yeah, something.
Gotcha. Well, you know, we hope you learned something new from this, and we, as always, try to inspire, educate you, and at the same time get your mind churning on some of these things.
Yeah, and you know, don't be afraid to do your own research, you know, on the subject. You know, we're not experts. You know. We kind of wing it half the time.
Well, not all the time. I mean, you know, the thing is, it's all about it's a lot about your perspective. What do you take?
Yeah.
What do you take from it? That's the only way that like people can really, really learn and grasp history.
Yeah.
Is like what do I take from like how does studying a guy like Eisenhower help me in my everyday life? You know, and it's like it helps me be a good leader. It helps me look at the crazy things that he experienced, you know, it's like studying a bunch of different, you know, parents, you know, it's like that try to instill the wisdom on their kid.
But for me, like studying history is kind of like, I don't know. It's like a discipline, like, you know, studying like martial arts or carpentry or
any
cooking.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
Anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Any
all the martial artists are like, are you kidding me?
It's any that. I tell you what, studying Ike felt like learning a roundhouse kick.
Yeah, I felt like breaking boards, man.
But anyway, without further ado, we want to sign off. I'm Henry Lowe.
And I'm Jacob.
And this is the Lowe Bros History Podcast. We'll see you next time.
We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight. fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall go on to the end. Until in God's good time. Until in God's good time. Until in God's good time. Until in God's good time, we shall go on to the end. Until in God's good time, we shall go on to the end. Until in God's good time.